There are two forms of evidence, direct evidence and indirect evidence. Direct evidence is simply eyewitness testimony. Everything else in criminal trials, DNA, fingerprints, behaviors, forensic evidence, material evidence, any of that stuff, that's all indirect evidence. But Jesus was a premier evidentialist, and he understood the value and role of direct evidence, eyewitness testimony.
I go for gold like I'm getting a gun from James Bond. First shot, I'ma kill it, never remain calm. Clever with the lyrics, but fire dragon for Mulan. Fit for all this rap, just need
to. So my guest today is the legendary Jim Warner Wallace. Jim is a cold case homicide detective, and you may have seen him featured on Dateline or Fox News, True TV. He's a former atheist who came to faith after examining the evidence in the Gospels. He's written several books, Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, and now Forensic Faith. So, Jim, how are you, man?
Good. I'm doing good. I'm glad to be with you. Yeah, I hardly get a chance to talk about it. You know, it's funny when you write books, you kind of that first book ends up setting the tone for what you do after that. And so I'm just glad to be able to talk about some of the stuff that, especially in Forensic Faith, where really I'm trying to help people understand the rules of evidence so they can better communicate the truth of Christianity to people around them. A lot of times, you know, before we even start, it's not about what the case may be. It's about, well, how do I know how to present a case? Because that sometimes, as a part of a jury at least, is our biggest challenge. I'm always thinking at the beginning of an investigation about what is this thing going to look like in front of the jury 5 years from now. And I try to make sure that I'm doing things along the way with that goal in mind, because the goal is not to arrest somebody. The goal is to convict the true killer. So you can arrest the true killer, but if you don't convict them, you haven't really achieved the goal. So a lot of what we're trying to do in this book, Forensic Faith, is talk about, well, how do we assemble a case persuasively for people when people need maybe to have the evidence before they're willing to even consider the claims of Christianity?
Right. And you and I were dialoguing a little bit before, and I do want to jump into your Forensic Faith book. I may have some listeners that aren't familiar with what you've done. For those who aren't, could you just give them the brief, the rundown of how you came from atheism into the faith and now studying apologetics and teaching apologetics?
Yeah, I was not, I live in Southern California, and in Los Angeles County, the basin is so large. There are so many people here that it's not hard to go to be raised in this area and not really be part of a church or even necessarily communicate with anybody who is part of a church. There are so many people here in so many different small environments that it just was not my experience. Maybe if I'd been raised in the South, I'd have more of a chance of bumping into somebody who would have talked about Jesus or had that be part of their lives. But that just wasn't my experience growing up. And so in the end, I was about 35 before I ever took seriously the claims of Christianity, before I ever bought a Bible. My wife was more interested than I was, for sure. And so I, you know, eventually found myself in church, and I would have been more than happy to go to church, even as an unbeliever. And that would have been fine. But the pastor was clever enough to tempt me to buy a Bible. And that's what started this whole thing. And so I had a skill set in place that I just was the only way, you know, everyone comes into this in the context of whoever they are and what their experiences are. And the context for where I was is I didn't trust anybody or anything or any claims made by anybody. And so I was very, pretty skeptical. But I did have a skill set in place that allowed me to examine claims, looking for deception indicators, looking for the things that we typically look for when we're talking to suspects. And that's the stuff that I was trying to employ. You know, I'm trying to build a case in my own mind. Is this reasonable? I mean, to be honest, when I started, I thought this was just going to be an exercise in learning ancient wisdom, whether true or not, from the source. The source could be fictitious, but if the wisdom is ancient and has survived thousands of years, it might still be something that has value to me. And I was just interested in what are these ancient Judeo-Christian claims, wisdom claims. Maybe they had some value. I think that's probably that was the doorway that got me started looking at Jesus of Nazareth. But then again, once I got into it, I really started to investigate the claims under the criteria that we use to determine if somebody's telling the truth. And that's really how I became a Christian. I thought everyone, by the way, did this, right? I thought that everyone who becomes a Christian examines the claims of the Gospels evidentially. But of course, that's not true. And many of us, after becoming a Christian, I realized that, you know, there probably is some work that needs to be done just in terms of trying to help people see that there is a case you could make for this, especially young people. Like, I think we're in a culture right now where the entire media culture, everything from the glowing rectangle that we hold in our hands, these phones, tells us that, hey, there's a truth, there are truth claims out there that are supported by the facts, the science, the tested experiences of people, whatever. And then here we are, the Christians, saying, well, yeah, but over here, we just want you to believe this without any similar approach. And I don't think for a lot of young people, that is an effective way to approach the claims of Christianity. It wasn't for me. And so I became a Christian on the basis of the evidence. And that's what I write about in the books.
Yeah, you said it, man. A lot of Christians are Christian, but they're not really, they haven't really thought this out. I think a large part of your book, Forensic Faith, deals with that. You make a case for why Christians ought to study apologetics. Now, I've heard you tell your story before. What role did your wife play? As she was already a Christian, is that right? So what role did she play in all that?
Well, so she was raised as a cultural Catholic. So she was the kind of person who, growing up with her mom, had a very good experience. Her mom was a very thoughtful, Bible-reading Catholic. So she was somebody who had the text in her house, and she would read through that text. But when I first met my wife, for the first 18 years, really, I saw Catholicism as kind of the thing you might do on Christmas. And that was it. That was our only experience. That was probably why I say it was more of a cultural experience. Susie, like me, we didn't own a Bible. We'd never read the Bible. And we really had no idea what the claims of Christianity were. We did know what experiences in masses were like on holidays. So that was the kind of thing I just thought you did, right? It's kind of like, you know, people who would observe, Santa Claus on holidays. It doesn't have to be true for you to still have it as part of your cultural experience. And that was really where I think she was. So neither one of us were Christians until we were together for about 18 years. And then we understood, because I remember when I first examined the claims of Christianity in the scriptures, I asked her, I said, well, I don't understand why, if God does exist, he would have to do it this way. Can you explain to me what do you think? Why do you? And she couldn't answer those questions either, because that was just not her experience as a cultural a mass attender, basically. And so we had to kind of start at scratch and understand not just that the Gospels are reliable and what they tell us about Jesus of Nazareth, but we had to start to understand what is the gospel message of Christianity. And so that's really where we were. So, but for sure, I think that she was much more open to the notion of God's existence than I was, because I was somebody who would not just deny that Christianity was true. I didn't think there was a God that existed either. I was very much committed to my atheist views, and it never became a problem for us in our relationship, because it was just not the kind of thing that we ever traversed. It was the kind of thing that was assumed, at my part anyway. And I was here, I was living a life that I would have said, of course, I think all of us say this, right? That we are living this moral life under our own standard. And here I was working as a police officer. And, we just never, but then when we had kids, I think Susie's thought was, well, look, I know I was raised under this cultural model. Do we raise our kids that way? And like my dad, who's still a very committed atheist, I think I would have said, yeah, I'll go to church with you. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be true for it to be useful. And that's where my dad has the same view, not true, but useful. So that's where I would have said, I'll go. And that's why I went, not because I was trying to examine. You know, I've got a friend, Lee Strobel, who wrote The Case for Christ. And Lee and Leslie have a slightly different view. Leslie became a Christian first. And then that kind of irritated Lee, and Lee went on a quest to kind of disprove what it was that Leslie thought was true. Well, that wasn't me. Neither one of us were Christians. And I just I didn't think it was even worth trying to test. I mean, I didn't thought this is a fantasy, a fairy tale that doesn't even deserve my investigation. It doesn't even warrant my investigation. So I wasn't out to prove it right or wrong. I just, as I read through the Gospels, I found things in the Gospel accounts that had the texture and quality of the eyewitness accounts that I often read. Remember, when I'm working cold cases, I'm working cases that somebody has written about what eyewitnesses said 35 years ago, and those eyewitnesses are usually not available to me anymore. They're dead or whatever. Yeah. So now I've got to read these accounts from detectives. Often those guys are dead too. And now I've got to figure out, well, okay, I don't know. The guy who wrote this, I don't have access to him. And the guy he wrote about, or the girl he wrote about in their witness account, I don't have access to them either. So how do I determine if any of this junk is true? That's what I saw the Gospels as. Same thing. How do I determine if that stuff's true when I have no access to the writer or to the alleged witness? So that's really how I got into it and why I started it all. I just was provoked based on the nature of the accounts. I was provoked to investigate them because they seemed like, wow. And that's, and by the way, that's something that you can't really quantify. What I mean is there's a quality to eyewitness accounts. They always contradict each other. If I have five eyewitnesses to an account, trust me, they will look like they're all like crazy. Like there's going to be aspects of those eyewitness accounts that you're going to look at and say, there's just no way. But of course, as you work them, you see how they puzzle together and you understand that every eyewitness brings a specific set of experiences, interests, background, biases, whatever they are, into the observation. And that accounts for these differences. But they always have some differences. And the levels of differences is something you just start to understand as you work these cases. And so I understood that intuitively. And then when I started reading the Gospels, I thought, wow, it's right in that range I would expect to see in terms of the differences and the nature of the differences. You know, we did a movie called God's Not Dead 2. And in that movie, we talk a little bit about, I mean, they're only going to give me 6 minutes, right, to talk about the nature of variation between accounts. And that's what really was powerful for me and why I considered this worth doing, worth, you know, taking another step.
Yeah, you know, it seems like a very honest approach that that you had. You didn't really have an axe to grind necessarily against Christianity. It was just you wanted to see the truth, and that seems to be your perspective. And you know, you point at something that I feel like is a big problem is that there are Christians who go to church because it's a cultural thing to do, or because they've always done it, they're comfortable with it, and I also know others that are actually opposed, it seems, to apologetics, because I think they may be even afraid of asking these questions. These questions are, you know, intimidating at the surface. And then, you know, what I've noticed as an apologist is when I've asked these questions, there are people like you out there and others that are answering them. And I found answers that, you know, really spoke to the questions I had. So I like that perspective because we're asking the same questions. And, you know, we're seeing the same answers and then we're trying to interpret that data. And I think you do a good job of that in forensic faith. I like what you said about you feel like you're in a race. You mentioned Peter Boghossian, the atheist and philosopher. And you said you feel like you're in a race with someone like Peter who's trying to get to these Christians who don't have a solid foundation and don't have answers for their faith. And it's almost this race between you and a guy like Peter where, you know, he's after the same audience. You know, he'll present these ideas to the same group of Christians that maybe haven't studied out their faith, or college kids that go to a campus and they hear something they haven't heard before and it blows their mind and they lose, you know, the parents think, what happened to my kid? So I think this is you know, a large part of what you did with Forensic Faith. So maybe you could just expound on the motivation of writing Forensic Faith and just, you know, where that motivation came from.
Well, you're absolutely right about folks like Peter Boghossian, who started an entire movement called Street Epistemology, right? This idea of epistemology is just, how do we know what we know? How do we get there? What's the process by which we can know anything with any kind of certainty at all? And his argument is that when he approaches Christians, he discovers that they didn't take the same approach to making a decision about Christianity that they would even take to making a decision about what car to buy. You do much more research, he discovered, in making those kinds of decisions than he saw that Christians are making about making the decision for Christ. And so what he says is there's no point in talking about evidence with Christians, because that Christians don't use evidence to determine that Christianity is true. He tells his folks, what we have to do is take a step back and talk about epistemology. How do we reasonably know what we know? And if you could help Christians to think clearer, his argument is, they will certainly move away from Christianity because they didn't think clearly toward Christianity. Well, I think that's his observation is sadly probably true in the sense that most people we meet, you and I both, who are Christians, maybe have not taken an evidential approach to getting there. But I think that Boghossian's wrong in the sense that they could have. We could actually help them to do such a thing. So if someone like a street epistemologist would approach me, they're not going to be able to approach me on the basis of my I'm not thinking clearly about this, because this is how I became a Christian. I have now guarded myself against that approach, because I have taken a very clear evidential approach toward my Christian faith. Now, I wrote Forensic Faith because I'll tell you, and I didn't talk about this in the book because I originally put it in the book, and then I sent it to several friends, pastors. As a matter of fact, Rice Brooks, who is the pastor in Tennessee who wrote God's Not Dead, the movie series, he was one of my people who I sent the book to earliest. And he said, Jim, you got to take that part of the book out unless you're going to offend every pastor in the country. Because what I discovered, and I didn't write it in the book, but I'll tell you, is that as I wrote God's Crime Scene and Cold Case Christianity, I started to get asked to come church to church around the country, presenting the evidence for Christianity, presenting the evidence for God's existence to Christians. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered is that when I would get to these churches, for the most part, it wasn't the lead pastor necessarily who asked me to come. It was probably somebody like a deacon or an elder or somebody who had influence with the pastor, who had an appreciation for apologetics, even though the pastor didn't, and had asked me to come. And he had twisted the arm and convinced the pastor to let me come. And when I get there, I realize, wow, you know, I'm going to have to do one thing before I can even talk about the evidence for Christianity. I'm going to have to convince this pastor that we ought to talk about the evidence for Christianity, because I'm not sure that the leadership necessarily understands the value of it. And I'm not sure the church then, because we always follow our leaders, understands. In other words, I had written a book about the case for Christianity. I had written a book about the case for God's existence. I knew I needed to write a book about the case for making the case to begin with. And that's what Forensic Faith ended up being. It's a case for making the case. And of course, along the way, I hope it'll help believers evangelize it, to make the case for Christianity to others. So it really has become a book that most people use to teach themselves how to be good, better evangelists. But what it also does, I hope, is all of us who have a love of apologetics find ourselves in communities that may not share our passion. Well, I hope a book like this will help you make it clear to others. I can tell you what we've done. We have historically, as a church, redefined a term that is really a courtroom term, and we have redefined it in Christianese. The term is called testimony. What we see, and why do we even use this word? And you'll see all the time, people will say, share your testimony. They'll ask me, would you share your testimony? You started by asking for what? What is my personal testimony? Right. And what that really, where does that come from? Well, it comes mostly because we see this word used over and over again in the book of Acts, where people testify. But what are they testifying to? There are two forms of evidence, direct evidence and indirect evidence. Direct evidence is simply eyewitness testimony. Everything else in criminal trials, DNA, fingerprints, behaviors, forensic evidence, material evidence, any of that stuff, that's all indirect evidence. But Jesus was a premier evidentialist, and he understood the value and role of direct evidence, eyewitness testimony. What you see in the book of Acts are not people who are testifying to the power of Jesus in their lives and how they were changed, or what experience they had with Jesus, or how Jesus transformed their lives. No, testimony in the book of Acts is very much what it is in eyewitness accounts. It was testifying to what they had actually seen with their own eyes related to the resurrection of Jesus. And it's limited to that. As a matter of fact, when Judas is taken out of the mix, they replace Judas with Matthias. Why Matthias? Because he was one of those people, it says in Acts 1, who had seen Jesus from the baptism to the resurrection. In other words, he had eyewitness status, not because Jesus had, we don't even know how or what Jesus did in the life of Matthias. We don't know what his personal story is, but he wasn't going to be testifying about his personal story. He was going to be testifying about what he had seen. That's what made him an eyewitness. Now, what we don't do in this culture, in this generation anymore, is testify to the evidence we've examined for the resurrection. Mm. We could. That's what they did in the book of Acts. Right. Instead, what we do is we typically tell the story of how our lives have been impacted by the Holy Spirit, by Jesus, all good stuff. But trust me, this is exactly what every religious group does. You probably know from my personal story, I've got six half brothers and sisters, all raised Mormon, LDS. And if you ask them why they are Mormons, they give the same answers that most Christians give, which is one, I was raised in the church. Two, I had an experience that demonstrated my view is true. Right. I've had an experience of the Holy Spirit that demonstrated that Joseph is a prophet of God and the Book of Mormon is true. Well, if we're going to come out and say what makes us true is our testimony, I was raised in the church, or I had an experience I can testify about, well, you're no better than your Mormon friends and you don't believe Mormonism is true. Why would you take the same approach as another group that, and by the way, those are the two most popular answers in every theistic worldview, Buddhism, Islam, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, whatever it is.
Wow.
But it turns out we could be testifying instead to the evidence for Christianity as presented historically, as presented in the resurrection. The resurrection, if the resurrection is not true, none of this matters.
Yeah.
There are people who are saved Christians who cannot articulate, and if nothing else, look at it this way. A lot of our friends will resist this approach because they think theologically it's not grounded well. They'll think that, hey, God does this kind of thing. But let me just tell you, God does not even need us to share the gospel. If God's as powerful as we know he is, he could actually just bring people to faith without even using words on the part of humans who are sharing anything about the gospel. The question is not, the question is, what are we going to share? That's the question. Like, what are the words that are going to come out of our mouth that God is going to use to bring people to himself?
Right.
And that, I think, is really what it comes down to. And for people like me and for young people who have constructed, and the culture has now helped them to construct, evidential walls between you and the gospel message. They can't even hear it. It sounds like stupid. It sounds like fantasy.
Wow.
I mean, Star Wars, I have better, more reason to believe in the Star Wars notions, because at least I can see those in movies. I mean, honestly, we have to help young people pull down the walls that that the culture has constructed around them. And that's going to be being able to answer, you know, why is this true? Tell me why you think this is true. You know, we wrote another book with Sean McDowell called So the Next Generation Will Know. We always say that if you want to impact young people, you have to give two whys for every what. First why. Why is it true? Your what is a claim. A claim about Jesus. A claim about the Bible. A claim about God. Whatever. Tell me why that's true. Hmm. Okay, now you've demonstrated why you think that's true evidentially. Why do I care? Why should I care? That's the second why. It turns out the generation of Gen Z we're looking at right now, if you can simply provide two whys for every what you used to give without providing any whys, you will change an entire generation of young people who simply want to know. Because, by the way, every other claim made online, they're giving you whys. Mm-hmm. Why should this matter to you? This all seems like this stuff matters. That stuff doesn't. This stuff is contemporary to my lives. That stuff's what old people believe. Look. In the end, we have to help young people see why this is important to them and why it is actually true, especially when placed up against other competitive claims about worldview.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you hear this a lot from people that I guess are opposed to apologetics about, you know, why would you study this? Why would you study that? What I like about forensic faith is you use scripture to make a biblical case for studying apologetics. Not only that, but you've narrowed it down to this was their testimony. This is what they testified of. And so you hear this, and you've probably heard this question before. Well, Jim, if you've got evidence, what do you need faith for? What does faith come into to play? And so I think, and I'll let you answer that because you do a great job of it, but this idea that faith is blind, the faith is just this blind faith. Yeah.
The idea of blind faith, I think, comes from a couple of – first, philosophically, if you're saying that something can be demonstrated as true evidentially, then what role does faith play? That's a good – just a simple philosophical question. Hmm. The second way that I see this discussed is that, well, hey, I just don't – I see in the scripture there seem to be several places – where it seems that we're told, you know, Thomas, for example, is told by Jesus, you know, you're blessed for having seen this, but blessed are those who haven't seen this yet still believe. So I think you have to approach it both ways. So what is the philosophical answer to the question? And then what is the biblical answer? I think that philosophically, that no matter what I do in criminal trials where I have a jury, I will not be able to answer and eliminate and remove every lingering question in the mind of jurors. it just can't be done. I wish it could be done. And I instruct jurors. We actually select jurors in the voir dire process, and we will actually ask them, hey, if you're the, are you the kind of person who has to have every question answered before you can render a verdict? If they say, yeah, I'm kind of, that's who I am, we're not going to impanel them, because we know we're going to have several key. I've had a case one time where I couldn't tell you where the body of the victim was because he got rid of the body. I couldn't tell you how he killed her, when he killed her, where he killed her, and how he moved her body. I couldn't tell you any of those things. Those are key, important questions. Yet we convicted him. And after we convicted him, he did tell us where the body was, but not until we convicted him. Mm-hmm. And so I have to tell jurors that even though I can make a strong case that will point you to my defendant with beyond a reasonable doubt, there still will be lingering open questions. And that step you take at the end of the evidence trail to your verdict is not a blind step, but it will be a step across the unanswered questions. You might even term that kind of a step of faith, but it's not an uninformed faith. It is an informed trust on the basis of evidence, even though there's a gap in the evidence to the very end. And that's where we are as Christians. It's not that we're being asked to step off from the very beginning. We have a long, strong evidence trail, at the end of which you probably have open questions. I get it. I have open questions too. But that step I take across the void is an informed step. When Jesus tells Thomas that those who don't see him will be blessed, the very next line it says in the same gospel that he continued to give many evidences to them about the resurrection. Well, okay, is this a contradiction in terms? No, what he's saying is, people will be blessed by your eyewitness testimony because you got to see this. And it's, this idea is that you got to see, and all the rest of you will be my witnesses in the world, and they will be blessed by your eyewitness testimony. It's not blind. They'll be blessed by something evidential, eyewitness testimony, direct evidence. And that's what Jesus did. He spent 40 days with the disciples in Acts 1 after the resurrection, giving them many more convincing proofs. In the Greek, that word for proofs is a word used for evidence. Yeah. So you think about that. Jesus spends 40 days after the resurrection giving his disciples, preparing his disciples with evidence so that they can then testify about this evidence to the world around them. And that is something that, to me, is the heart of an evidentialist. You also see it, for example, when John the Baptist sends his disciples to Jesus with a question. If anyone should have confidence that Jesus is the Messiah, it should be John the Baptist, who baptized him, who is his cousin, who wept in the womb. Yet here's the guy who has the most questions, or has some questions, and he sends his disciples. And Jesus responds not with the way that I think a lot of us as pastors today in America might respond. Right. You need to pray about this. You need to just trust. But no, he actually performs three additional miracles for the disciples and then tells them to go back and tell John what they just saw. Okay, that is the heart of an evidentialist. Yeah. And in the end, he responds to doubt, the doubt of John the Baptist, in the way an evidentialist would respond. Yeah. And that gave me great encouragement. This is one of the things about the Gospels that encouraged me as a non-believer, is that this was not something that was just a set of proverbs, a set of, a proverbial statements on the part of a wise teacher. Just trust that it's true. Maybe your experience will confirm for you that these statements are reasonable and true. No, this was an evidentialist who always worked a miracle in front of his audience before he would start to preach to them. He would heal, then herald. Now, Peter knew this was the case for a reason. He said in the Pentecost sermon that Jesus was a man attested to you by the evidence of miracles. In other words, Jesus knew, and he said this, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe on the evidence of the miracles I've worked in front of you. And this approach of providing evidence first, then saying something, and this is why Peter then says, you ought to know that he is who he said he was, because he was attested by those miracles. That, to me, was a powerful way in for a guy who really needed to have evidence before I could even lay down the walls I had constructed between the gospel and myself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just listening to this, you know, it's just so important. I don't think people read the Gospels with the right viewpoint, and they miss that. They miss, you know, the humanity that's in these men and even these women that they really did have questions the same way you and I. And, you know, I think we think that because they walked with Jesus, they didn't have these questions. And it's clear that they had those questions. And that actually makes their testimony even more reliable because they were wrestling with these things.
Yes.
You know, I was reading through, you know, kind of gleaning from your book. I know that you're a fight fan. Is that correct? You're a boxing fan?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm a big MMA fan, so I watch a lot of the UFC and stuff. I keep up with that. I train jiu-jitsu at my local gym, and one of the things that jumped out to me as somebody who trains and enjoys that was you talked about your son and how he was, you know, an officer, and he was in training, and he got to grapple with one of the best jiu-jitsu guys in your area, and he came back, and he was just kind of like, man, I got to train harder. I got to get better, and I think that it points to a big principle. I love what you say in your book. You said, you know, we need to stop teaching and start training. And right. That leapt out to me. So maybe you could expound on what that looks like for Sunday school teachers out there or parents out there or, you know, ministers out there that are listening to this and say, why would we stop teaching and start training? What does that look like in order to prepare this next generation to defend the gospel?
Yeah, I mean, boxers train. They train because they're going to get in the ring. MMA fighters train because they're going to get in the cage. I mean, you know, at some point on the eve, I'm sure that people are nervous on the eve of a big fight because they know that they've been training and they probably wonder, did I train enough? Did I do enough to be ready tomorrow when I get in that ring? And so I think what makes the difference between teaching and training is simply that you train because you're going to have to get in the ring. In other words, there's something on your calendar that is coming up that is going to test in a severe way or in a dramatic way the stuff that you've been learning. And if you didn't have that event on your calendar, you probably would have the same kinds of teaching sessions, but they wouldn't be pointed toward anything. And imagine, for example, if you are in your college curriculum and you have a class in, say, trigonometry or in calculus, and your teacher says to you, hey, you know, the way I teach this course, I'm not going to give you tests. Okay. There won't be any tests. You're not going to be graded on anything. I just want you to pay attention and I'm going to teach you the calculus, but there'll never be a test. How much time do you really think you're going to spend outside of that classroom thinking about calculus when you've got other courses you have to take, those that have tests, and you're going to have to study for those tests? Well, it turns out you're going to be paying attention because there's a test on your calendar for every other course in your curriculum. And there is no test on that class. So, you know what? Just show up. And blah, 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 out, don't really care, not being tested. Well, here's what we're doing with young people is we're preparing them spiritually with some head knowledge, let's say, about what we're teaching from Scripture. But every other aspect of their young life, and here in Southern California, we see this in areas where, you know, kids are preparing for their college career or trying to get ready for the SAT or trying to get ready to where the next step is going to be for them educationally. Well, they're being tested in every other aspect of their academic studies. Even if they're not in classes or college prep, they're still going to have tests. Now, there's no test at Sunday school. There's no test at church. This is just show up. Just show up. Well, it turns out that as I was a youth pastor, I realized if I simply would put something on the calendar that would exercise what I had been teaching them, everything begins to shift toward training because we know, hey, this is coming up in 2 weeks. This is coming up in a week. We're doing this tomorrow. I mean, people see the urgency of it. This is one of the reasons why, for example, if you watch the NBA or watch baseball in the first part of a season, you're like, eh, there's no sense of urgency. But if in the NFL, there's only 16 games, you lose a couple of those games early, guess what? You could be out of the playoffs. So it seems like every game has a better sense of urgency, especially in college football, right? You lose one game, you're out of the championships. So it really is a sense of urgency about each of these events. Well, what I'm trying to do with my young people is to give them a sense of urgency about each time we meet, because they know we're getting ready to do something. And if you miss one or two of these, you won't be ready to do it. Now, we set on the calendar events that will exercise the areas, the theological areas that we are interested in teaching. I call this TAB training, T-A-B, theology, apologetics, behavior. So we would say, that there are claims made by scripture, theological principles. We need to master those. Mm-hmm. We need to understand where those differ from other theistic systems. Why this matters that we get this right.
Right.
We need to also be able to defend why this, you know, what evidentially makes this true, because that's going to be a challenge of culture. And so that's the apologetics side of it. And then finally, if all this stuff is true and can be defended, it ought to have an outcome in how you behave. It ought to have, it ought to express itself somehow in a changed life. Well, that's the behavior side. So what we wanted to do is to put something on the calendar in those three areas so we could teach and train up to it. And that's as simple as it is. And by the way, youth pastors, I was a youth pastor for a number of years. While my kids were in high school, I was their youth pastor. And we had stuff on the calendar. It's not like youth pastors aren't having to prepare for camps and retreats. The question is, are these camps and retreats the event that will test, or are they just another weekend where all you have to do is show up? You're never going to be asked to do anything with this. You know, have some fun snowboarding. At the end of the day, when you're exhausted and ready to go to bed, we'll do an hour message, some worship music, go to sleep, snowboard the next day. I mean, I see a lot of youth ministry is kind of like this, right? Where that retreat is just a place to have some fun and then sit in another sermon. Well, we did replaced all of those kinds of trips with trips that activated what we had been training for weeks. So if we wanted to do a theology trip, we'd take the kids to Salt Lake City. It's about 12 hours from us. We can drive there in a day. And then you're on the streets of Salt Lake City sharing the gospel with people who think they understand the gospel. Yeah. And they see you as the lost people group. And trust me, those conversations are robust, theologically rich, and challenging. And kids love to do it. We had a great time. We did this. It just continued to grow every year we did it. We also took a trip for apologetics to Berkeley. And in Berkeley, you know, that's a very kind of secular school here in California. And that was a place where you could now encounter people who are either apathetic or atheist or just not anti-Christian sometimes. And you can kind of get involved in conversations. And we would set up opportunities to put our kids in face-to-face situations that would challenge them. For behaviors, oftentimes people would say, well, what does the transformed life look like? It's a life of service. And so we're talking about, well, how do we serve our community? What opportunities we can provide? How do we better prepare in front of that opportunity to serve well in that situation? What does the transformed life look like? So we would prepare these tab trips, tab events on our calendar, got rid of all the camps and retreats, replaced them with tab trips, and now our entire calendar turned from teaching to training. That makes the difference, I think, in leading young people.
Wow. You know, one of the first apologetics events I was able to attend, Brett Kunkel was teaching there. And I know that you guys have done some work together in the past.
Yes.
And he told some of these stories about taking his youth group to a Buddhist temple at one point. And
yes.
You know, so these, and I just thought, man, this is so cool to hear. And how much the kids loved that. They loved being challenged. They loved someone, you know, kind of having that dialogue back and forth. And you said in your book, I think it's so good, that as parents, we're the first apologists, or, you know, that our kids encounter. If you have kids,
right,
you're the apologist. You're the one who will equip them or not equip them to defend their faith. And so I feel like, you know, for parents out there listening, this is huge, learning to train instead of just, you know, hey, we have to go to Sunday school today and you got to memorize your verse, and that's all good, but train them, ask them these questions. You're watching a film, stop the film and ask, you know, what worldview is being presented here? And
that's right.
And how would you respond to it? And you have a test in forensic faith, you know, a few questions that they can actually take a test themselves, or, you know, look through it and go, where do I stand? How could I answer these questions if they were presented? And I just think that's so important for people to get a handle on that, to train their kids, to prepare for those things. And so this is why I think Forensic Faith is a great book for those who, you know, don't know really what the principles are that drive apologists and want to get into apologetics and maybe need to start, you know, Forensic Faith, also God's Crime Scene, Cold Case Christianity. Those are all good books for people who are just interested in starting. Not sure where to start. I would recommend, I told you before the podcast, it was one of my first books to read was God's Crime Scene in regards to apologetics. And so it was easy for me to understand, and it was a great starting point for me. You talk about the three-fourth principle, And I think a lot of people, you know, if not everyone, fall under one of these categories. The first category being believers who are convinced of their position. The second, believers who are starting to have some doubts. The third would be non-believers who maybe are doubting their non-belief, or it's sort of a circular idea. So, and then the fourth, just the convinced non-believer, the person who is just adamant they are an atheist and they can tell you why. So I wonder if you could unpack that, and what do we do about that fourth category there, Jim? How do we reach those who are, you know, they are 100%, they're atheistic and they're not changing, they're not breaking away from that no matter what. So maybe unpack the three-fourth principle and what do we do with that?
Yeah, when I talk about the three-quarter principle, it's just that whenever this is like jury selection, right? We have these four groups, people who are pro-prosecution at one extreme, people who are pro-defense at the other, and then people in the middle who might be on one side or the other of what they think, what they appreciate or what they value, but they are open and they are reasonable. So if there's enough evidence to convict, they will. If there isn't enough, they won't. They're the reasonable middle. What we're trying to do in jury selection is get rid of the hard edges and just select the reasonable middle, even though they might be naturally inclined in one direction or the other, they are still reasonable and open and willing to suspend their bias. Well, in the world we talk to, there are people in those four positions as well. Christians who are committed, atheists who are committed, people in the middle who are maybe on one side of the issue or the other, but they're not antagonistic. They're not anti the other position. And by the way, this is getting harder and harder to find, especially on a social media world where you can make claims, you can be in conversation with people without ever seeing them, without ever being physically present. And that's when you see the most extreme reactions, the most extreme languages used, when you don't think you're ever going to have to confront. This is why, for example, a sit-down meeting between two people who are opposed is so powerful, right? Because sit-downs, it's hard to retain your adamant position against the other person when you meet them face-to-face. But if we're going to be involved in a social media world where we're never going to have to see each other face to face, I mean, honestly, the most contact we're going to have is I know your icon on Twitter. It's not even your real face. And then I just have your words as you pound out whatever you're pounding out against me on Twitter. You're going to see the most polarized conversations you could possibly have in that kind of an environment. Well, it turns out the edges then are more polarized than ever. So I know when I speak to people about Jesus, only three of the four groups are paying attention. That three-quarter principle is basically that the convinced Christian, the Christian who's maybe by name but not always that convinced, and the open-minded non-Christian, they might be paying attention. But the adamant non-Christian, the anti-theist, is not paying attention. He's simply looking for a way to stab you again. You know. Now, by the way, this category exists on both sides. I'm not to say that there aren't Christians who are also looking for, like, both sides have hammers looking for nails, okay? That's just the way it is, all right? But when you're speaking about the gospel, you have three out of the four paying attention. Now, why that's important is because you all know somebody who you would consider a category four, somebody who is absolutely opposed, especially during the holidays when you get a chance to kind of be interacting with family members. You may know somebody in your own family who's a four. So there's a strategy for fours that I've been taking with the fours in my life. I was a four for most of my friends for most of my life. The strategy is that you pray for fours and you model Christ for fours, because I'm not so fond of apologetics that I think the apologetics or my arguments have the power of God. No, God has the power of God. So what you do is somebody prayed me from position four into position three. And from there, the evidence presented to me, or my own investigation of the evidence, made sense. I was open to it. I was not opposed, so opposed that I was not willing to listen anymore. But that was not the case for a lot of years. And what we do is I've seen this. We'll pray for people and pray for people and model Christ. In other words, not give them another reason to not like Jesus, because they don't like the Jesus follower. And then at some point, when you see that God has moved them into position three, it usually is going to be by way of a conversation, when suddenly they seem more receptive than they've ever seen before. And then you'll have these conversations. And sometimes it's easier to credit yourself with movement. It wasn't you, unless, of course, your prayers were being heard. But it wasn't you in terms of your clever argument. More than likely, it was just that God is now, in the timing of God, has moved that person into a position where they're actually. And by the way, the words you're using, this is also true for people who just share the gospel without any evidence. You can share the gospel with people and they just bounces off because they're in that position four, and then God moves them and suddenly they're hearing it. And by the way, They will also remember every conversation you had for all those years when it was just bouncing off. Mm. So what you do is you pray and you model for group four. And then once they move in, but here's what I don't do. I don't go back and continue to try to hammer that nail. Because all that's doing is until I see, I mean, I'm very careful of my words with that group because I know that this is an act of God, that will a work of God that has to occur. And I can, in other words, I don't feel like, wow, I hear I shared the gospel again and nothing happened and you're discouraged. Well, no, remember that this is a game of baseball. It's not a game of tennis. It's not just you and the opponent on the other side of the net. It's a one-on-one sport. That's not how this works. People are involved with you over a period of years, helping your loved ones move around the base path. And you don't know where they are on that base path. And so you might feel like you didn't accomplish anything because you only see and only count home runs. But you've actually moved them around the base path. And then somebody else comes along a couple of years later and moves them a little further. And at some point they come all the way home. And I try not, I know I don't get the credit for moving someone home because I'm not involved in that entire base path. I just happen to be the last 5 feet. I also don't get frustrated when I move them 5 feet, but it's not all the way home. So by understanding the role that I play in the context of a team that moves people around the base path, I have, number one, reduced the amount of time that I get frustrated. And number two, taking the edge off the pride I might experience if someone does come to faith. Because it's what's God's using all of us on this team. Our only responsibility is to get up and make contact with the ball. And if you don't get up and make contact with the ball, then nothing's going to happen. So just get off the bench and you'll be used in some way to move people around the base path.
Yeah, that's so encouraging because there's parents out there that I feel like they may have a four as a child and they say, man, we've had these tough interactions. We've argued back and forth, and we've fought over this, and I don't know what to do. And I think you make a good point here. Just live that gospel, because if we trust that the gospel is true and that Jesus radically changes our lives, you living that out in front of someone, it is going to be something different. It is going to speak to them. And then, of course, if they come to that place in their life, and I think they will, where they start to really have these questions, now you have some answers for them. And that's another important, you know, I've been talking about forensic faith for Christians who are already Christians, but I feel like forensic faith is, as an apologist too, we need to read the book, because I think apologists start to feel this, you have this power where you're going to put forth this right argument and you're going to can change the person's mind. So it's not just for people who aren't familiar with apologetics. It's a reminder also for those of you who have been studying it, that we are not in a place where we're that powerful, where I can actually, you know, now I believe God can use us to do some amazing things by presenting these arguments, but it's God, it's not us. And I think as apologists, we need a reminder that this isn't really about our strength or our knowledge or our wisdom, our capabilities. At the end of the day, it's trusting God. And that's where the faith aspect, for those who are wondering where faith comes into play in all this, There's trust in God that I'm allowing him to take this person that is a four and just bring them to a place where they'll be open to some questions. You know, so
this is something I'll tell you that I'm more relaxed about, primarily because I was so much older when I became a Christian. So if you knew me at 34, you would never have seen this coming. You would never have thought, well, here's where he's going to be at 36. So that would have been a shock, I think, for most of my friends. And because I've seen that in my own life, I have more patience with the people I'm around because, you know, my own kids even. When I was their age, I was not nearly as far along as they are. And you probably have somebody in your life, too, where you're thinking, wow, you know, I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. It seems like it's never. There are people, believe it or not, who become Christians at my age now. So it's not just be patient. And I think because that was my own journey, it helps me be patient with others.
Right. Well, last question for you, Jim, and I'll let you go.
Okay.
In your postscript, you talk a little bit about a sheepdog. What's that look like? What's a sheepdog look like? And why should we aspire to be sheepdogs?
Well, you know, there are sheepdog ministries around the country, and they typically serve first responders, law enforcement, or military families, because those folks see themselves in a role. You know, in every yard, every pasture, you've got sheep and wolves. And sadly, the sheepdog stands in the middle, guarding the sheep from the wolves. What's interesting about sheepdogs is that for the most part, sheep don't see the difference between a sheepdog and a wolf. They're both canines to the dumb sheep. Now, we are called sheep by Jesus, but that is not a compliment if you've ever raised sheep. These are not the most intelligent animals. They're typically pretty dirty, and they aren't even aware of the danger sometimes or how and why it is their numbers are being thinned by wolves that are picking them off at night. The sheepdog, though, that job of that dog is to basically protect. And this is why sheepdog ministries are usually reserved or given, the title is given to those ministries that serve protectors, first responders, or law enforcement or military, because we're in that role. But it turns out that there's good evidence in scripture that all of us are to become sheepdogs. We are sheep to begin with. That is true. And by the way, the sheepdog and the sheep both have a master, the shepherd. It's not, we're not asking people to become the shepherd. Okay, that's the shepherd. Sheepdogs are simply in a different role in that yard. Both of these sheep and the sheepdog are led by the shepherd. But the sheepdog's got a role that I think if there, I know one thing for sure, if there were, there were more sheepdogs, there wouldn't be a need. Look, we have a wolf problem because we don't have enough sheepdogs. Yeah. We have a wolf problem because but the yard was full of sheepdogs, would there be no wolf problem at all? So the problem we have right now is that we've got a lot of sheep who aren't prepared to make a defense for what they believe or even help somebody else who maybe now is starting to have questions. We have to shift. And I honestly think that God's desire for us in our maturity is for all of us to be able to defend what we believe. We see that call to be able to discern truth and defend what you believe is not a call that's limited to a certain group in the church. The way that, for example, in Ephesians, Paul says that some of you are pastors, some of you are evangelists, some of you are teachers. That means that some of you aren't those things. So if you feel like, I'm not a pastor, I don't teach, I'm not an evangelist, you know, by trade, okay, I get it. Paul says that some of you won't be those things. But Peter says that all of you are to be able to give a reason for the hope you have in Jesus. In other words, the duty of apologist is one that we all have to embrace, because he doesn't say some of you can give a hope for the reason, no, a reason for the hope. He says all of you. That means that's one, I don't know why it is, for example, we sometimes feel bad that we don't share the gospel, but we don't feel bad that we can't defend the gospel. Yeah. We ought to, because that's the one thing we're told. We have to move from sheep to sheepdog. And the kind of sheepdog we're being asked to be is, you know, you got to decide, you know, what kind of sheepdog you want to be. And I find, for example, that some of us, when we're not prepared, we bark a lot because we feel like chihuahuas, right, in the yard, because we feel like we're constantly under attack and we don't have the skill set we need. We're not big enough to defend ourselves. So we bark a lot like we're the smallest dog in the yard rather than like the Great Dane. And it turns out, of the philosophical worldviews, Christianity is the Great Dane of worldviews. So you don't have to bark like a chihuahua. If you simply knew why this is true in a way you could articulate, imagine you're having to articulate this to doubting teenagers. If you're able to do that, you will realize at some point you'll have confidence. And with confidence comes passion. People aren't passionate to share the gospel because they're worried that they're not prepared to answer questions. They're not prepared to say it the right way. Whatever it is, it's preparation. They don't feel prepared, and that ruins their passion. Well, it turns out if you would simply prepare yourself, you'll find that you're a much more passionate, confident evangelist. So that's what I'm hoping the book like this will do, is it will move you toward that kind of confidence. So that, number one, you're protected from those folks like Peter Boghossian, who would say, hey, you people are so unreasonable. All I have to do is help you learn how to reason, and you'll stop being a Christian. Well, actually, if you know how to reason using the evidence, I actually became a Christian this way.
Yeah.
So you're right. We're both after the same group. It's a matter of who's going to get to that group first. Yeah. And I think that our goal, your goal, my goal, is to reach the church before people like Peter Boghossian reaches them.
Yeah, such a good point to end it on. Forensic Faith is the book, God's Crime Scene, Cold Case Christianity, and your website is coldcasechristianity.org.com.
Both will get you there, but .com is where you can we point people. Yeah, for sure.
All right, so I strongly suggest those who are interested in what we've talked about, parents out there, you've got books for kids, you got God's Crime Scene for kids, Forensic Faith for kids. So there's so many good teaching tools and things where they can find you at. So, Jim, it's been an honor having you on, and I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm really happy that we got to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. Let's do it again. I'm going for gold.
Never will I assume haters. I want the bass of my music to have the moon shaking. I want the lyrics I spit to have all your views changing. The rock removed and he saved us, wasn't the Tomb Raider. I got some new flavor, I'll let you later. I beat the beast and I feast with God at a new table. In the valley is where I keep my views stable.